appalling demoralization in the ranks. There were even cries for McClellan's restoration. In part to prove his critics wrong, Burnside now launched a campaign to strike a mortal blow to the rebellion. The plan was to cross the Rappahannock upstream of Fredericksburg and try to get behind Lee's position on Mary's Heights. Once again, the plan looked reasonable on paper, but then a cold, wind-driven rain started falling, which turned into a howling nor'easter. Soon the army, trudging upstream along the Rappahannock, found itself in what one soldier called a complete sea of mud. Wagons sank to their hubs, horses to their fetlocks. Mules sank completely out of sight in the middle of the road. There was obviously no way to continue, so Burnside called it off, ending once and for all his abortive winter campaign against Robert E. Lee. But he was just beginning his campaign to punish his own generals for their insubordination and conspiracy against him. He drew up formal dismissals of the offending officers, including Hooker, Smith, and Franklin. Since he had to get presidential approval for such an action, he traveled to Washington, where he told Lincoln, in effect, fire them or accept Burnside's resignation. Lincoln chose the latter. He relieved Burnside and gave the command to Hooker, about whom he had reservations. "Hooker does talk badly," he said, "but the trouble is he is stronger with the country today than any other man." Part 5. All That Is Ever Given to a Man. Chapter 43. Winter of Dreams. 18 months after the first shot at Fort Sumter, there were certain truths that the soldiers had come to know. Death in war was neither picturesque nor peaceful, and dying bravely didn't make you any less dead, or mean that you would not be dumped into the cold earth of a mass grave with everyone else, brave and not brave. Nor was there likely to be anyone to hear your last miserable words. People of the era cherished the idea of a good death, a peaceful, dignified passing, wherein God was embraced and sins repented and salvation attained, preferably in your own bed with your family gathered devotedly around to hear your last murmurs of Christian resignation. War made a mockery of all that. War made a mockery of the idea of a benevolent God. It replaced the family home with the rank, powder-scorched horrors of the battlefield. These were the new truths. In war, you lived outdoors like a wild animal. You lived in a blistering heat, drenching rains, and knife-like cold. You were exposed and vulnerable. The majority of men who died did not even have the honor of dying in a fight. 2 out of 3 were carried away by diseases that killed them just as surely as mini-balls. Those who survived did so on 1/4 pound of bacon and 18 ounces of flour a day, 1/3 the regular meat ration, with the infrequent small issue of rice, molasses, or sugar. The rice ration was 1 ounce. Men lived without shoes or coats or blankets. Food was short all over the South. Soldiers hunted up sassafras buds and wild onions to ward off scurvy. Horses died for lack of forage. In Richmond, where much of the Eastern Army's fare was gathered and transshipped, there were bread riots. In spite of these hardships, which seemed to multiply as the war dragged on, many of the men in the Confederate States Army remembered the winter of 1862-63 as one of the most extraordinary times of their lives. After the Battle of Fredericksburg, they went into winter quarters on the right bank of the Rappahannock. They did not break camp until 4.5 months later. In this period of sudden and miraculous leisure, free of fighting and marching, but with sharp, fresh memories of death and hardship, they experienced their own lives more keenly than ever before. As artillerist Edward Porter Alexander wrote later, echoing the sentiments of many of his comrades, "It was one of the happiest periods of all my life." That happiness took many forms. In the joyous Christian revivals that continued to sweep through the army, in singing and band concerts and social visits and elaborately staged shows and snowball fights, and quiet evenings before fires, smoking pipes and talking about the battles they had fought, the comrades who had died, and this extraordinary war to decide the fate of the nation that they found themselves in the middle of. It was a time to take inventory of oneself and one's life, a time when men could dream again about something more than surviving to fight the next battle. For Jackson and his Second Corps, this unusual interlude began at a place called Moss Neck, one of the most magnificent estates in Virginia. They had stumbled into it in darkness, about 8 miles south of where they had fought. A newly constructed brick mansion in the Greek Revival style, measuring 250 feet from wing to wing, trimmed out with teak and mahogany and ornate plaster carvings, and elevated on a picture book knoll that overlooked the Rappahannock Valley. His staff made inquiries. The place belonged to the Corbin family. Though the man of the house, 29-year-old Richard Corbin, was off fighting with the 9th Virginia Cavalry, the house had 6 occupants. Richard's 27-year-old wife, Roberta, Bertie, and their 5-year-old daughter, Jane Welford Corbin, Janie. His 23-year-old sister, Catherine, Kate Corbin, and his other sister, 24-year-old Nettie Corbin Dickinson, and her children, Jane Park, 4, and Gardner, 2. The Corbins invited Jackson to stay with them and make his headquarters there. He declined but was persuaded to accept the offer of an outbuilding 130 feet from the house, used by the family as an office. There was a small lobby in front, a closet for wood, a narrow staircase to the attic, and a fireplace with a cot on one side and a table, chair, and stools on the other. In the manner of Virginia country homes, the main room was festooned with paintings and engravings of racehorses and hunting dogs. Here Jackson would spend the winter. Christmas dinner at Moss Neck offered a glimpse of the pleasantly aberrant season to come. The affair took place in Jackson's office and was attended by Generals Robert E. Lee, Jeb Stuart, and William Pendleton, along with select members of their staffs, 10 guests in all. Considering the privations of war that were visible all around them, the meal Jackson's new aide, James Power Smith, put on was extraordinary. Almost all of the foods were gifts. 3 turkeys, a ham, a bucket of oysters, a box of fine food sent by ladies from Stanton, pickled vegetables, and even a bottle of wine. Jackson's servant Jim baked some white biscuits from regular rations. There was a plate of butter in the table's center bearing the ornate imprint of a fighting cock. To serve it all in this room festooned with images of the sporting life of upper-class Virginia was a slave named John, who was assigned to Jackson's staff, turned out in a white apron. The effect was startling. Lee and Stuart both reacted by making jokes at Jackson's expense. Lee said that Jackson and his staff were merely playing at being soldiers. They should come to Lee's headquarters to see how soldiers really lived. Stuart, pretending that Jackson himself had chosen the office decor, launched an attack on the general's questionable taste. As Smith recalled it, Stuart toured the room, commenting on the paintings in solemn tones, saying that he wished to express his astonishment and grief at the display of General Jackson's low tastes, and that it would be a sad disappointment to the old ladies of the country who thought that Jackson was a good man. He concluded by pointing to the Chanticleer-imprinted butter, thundering, "If there is not the crowning evidence of our host's sporting tastes, he even puts his favorite gamecock on his butter." Throughout Stuart's tirade, Jackson grinned and blushed. He liked Stuart immensely, and never minded being teased by him. The next day, Stuart led one of his trademark raids that had made him, for many Southerners and Northerners alike, the most glamorous officer in the war. He crossed the Rappahannock upstream with 1,800 horsemen and 4 guns and struck a supply depot 20 miles into Yankee-held territory. Facing stiff resistance, he turned north instead of south, captured a Union telegraph office just 15 miles from Washington, and sent a wire to Union Quartermaster Montgomery Miggs complaining that the substandard mules he was capturing were not up to the job of pulling all the provisions he was stealing. He returned to Fredericksburg on New Year's Day with 200 prisoners, 200 captured horses, 100 arms, and 20 wagons stuffed with loot. While the generals feasted in the office, Bertie Corbin threw a sumptuous party in the parlors of the main house. The featured attraction was her unmarried and very engaging sister-in-law, Kate. Several of Jackson's younger staffers, including Clement Fishburne and Sandy Pendleton, were already falling for her. Fishburne later wrote that he was very nearly in love, but discovered before I became hopelessly gone that my friend Colonel A.S. Pendleton was likely to be a successful applicant. He also noted that several other officers were further gone than I was, and that some of them actually proposed. Moss Neck became the center of life in Jackson's corps that winter. In the Army's camps that spread outward from the estate, men quickly learned to build wooden huts against the unusually cold Virginia weather. Bertie Corbin wrote one of the best descriptions of life there. "Thousands of soldiers in sight," she recalled, "the hills echoing with noises of Army life, fife and drum, brisk tattoo and reveille, the sound of many axes, the crashing of great trees as they fell. All became our daily fare of strange experience." The great forests surrounding Moss Neck were literally mowed down. Almost instantly there sprang into life settlements of wooden huts. How the sounds of camp life haunt me still. The hum of voices, the music of the bands, especially the Stonewall Brigade Band, stationed right in front of the house. Hers was not the only Virginia estate watching its forests razed to the ground. By one estimate, fully 30 square miles of timber on both sides of the Rappahannock were clear-cut by the armies. While Jackson enjoyed cordial relations with the older Corbins and was a frequent social guest at the main house, he developed a very special friendship with 5-year-old Janie, who visited him in his quarters in the afternoon. She was a bright, attractive child, with large eyes and light blonde hair. She was very much taken with the kind general. She would spend hours cutting out paper soldiers and parading them on his table. He always had a present for her when she came, an apple or orange, a piece of candy, or a bright print. One day he discovered that she had lost the comb that normally kept her long hair in place. He took his lieutenant general's hat in hand, the one Anna had given him, and with a penknife carefully removed the band of gold braid that encircled it and bound it around her head. Then, taking her head in his hands, he asked her to wear it for him. He later explained to Anna, "I became so ashamed of the broad gold lace that was on the cap you sent me as to induce me to take it off. I like simplicity." Janie came often, and the stern general and the golden-haired girl passed the time happily together. And this continued through the winter. On one occasion, Jackson was standing with several subordinates in the yard when the little girl emerged from the house, ran across the lawn, and clasped her arms around his leg, crying, "General Jackson, kiss me, please." Though his staff had seen him kiss her before, the public setting embarrassed him, and he declined. On March 16, the day he left Moss Neck for new headquarters, Jackson learned that Janie and her two young cousins were ill with scarlet fever. Before he left, he called on Bertie Corbin to express his concern. She told him that Janie appeared to be out of danger. A day later, she was dead. Her cousins died within a few days. He heard the news with an outburst of tears and a convulsed frame. He perhaps felt her death even more deeply because Anna had written him that his own daughter was ill. Though there were duties to keep the men busy that winter, drilling, as always, the occasional review, the building of defense works on the high ground of the South Bank, and the usual run of camp chores, there was also a good deal of free time. The winter at Moss Neck was a time for those rarest of wartime pursuits, reading and meditation. Jackson did a good deal of both. He devoted large chunks of the Sabbath to quiet prayer. He and his staff discovered the Corbin's library. Jackson especially liked Henry Hunter's Life of Moses. He wrote Anna that it was a delightful book. "I feel more improved reading it than by an ordinary sermon." His staff plunged into Shakespeare, Thackeray, Hugo, Dickens, Tennyson, and Browning. The very idea that there would be leisure time to read was new to them. Jackson's adjutant, Sandy Pendleton, not only found time to read, he also courted and won Kate Corbin, whom he would soon marry. But mostly that winter there was just talking. A lot of it. In the tents, around campfires, on long walks and rides that their lessened duties now afforded them. Jackson demonstrated that he could actually participate in light conversation. He welcomed a number of English visitors, holding forth at length on his favorite topic of medieval cathedrals, especially York Minster and Westminster Abbey. He sat before campfires with his staff, especially Hotchkiss and Maguire, and listened to and told stories. One night he spoke of his life as a teacher, saying that he'd been very fond of it. He spoke, too, of his love of the Spanish language and of certain idioms of both the Spanish and English languages. He even talked about his childhood and his family, especially about his beloved mother. Such conversation was without precedent at Stonewall Jackson's headquarters. He was clearly more relaxed, as was everyone else, including Robert E. Lee. In this more casual world of the winter camp, Lee, too, teased Jackson, once facetiously introducing him to two ladies, as the most cruel and inhuman man you have ever seen. When one of the ladies protested that she considered Jackson a Christian soldier, Lee replied, shaking his head, "Why, when we had the battle up at Fredericksburg, do you know, that it was as much as we could do to prevent him from taking his men, with bayonets on their guns, and driving the enemy to the river?" Jackson's staff even persuaded him to play a prank on General Jubal Early, who had taken to commandeering ambulances for social outings with lady friends. Over Jackson's signature, a note to Early demanded to know why ambulances were being deployed for frivolous purposes. "Great and hilarious was the merriment when Early's long report came," wrote James Power Smith later. Private soldiers seemed just as swept up in this new lighthearted feeling. In December, they built a theater out of logs and clapboard and staged amazingly elaborate performances every night, a combination of variety shows and burlesques on officers, quartermasters, and commissaries. In one, a soldier is told that his head wound would require his head to be amputated. He replies that at least then he'll be able to get a furlough, only to be told that his headless body is needed as a decoy to fool the enemy. The grandest show of all took place in February, put on by the Washington Artillery with music by the 12th and 16th Mississippi Regiments. Programs were printed in Richmond, and people came from 20 miles around to see it. Though Lee sent a letter of regret, Longstreet and other generals attended in full dress. The main feature was titled Pocahontas, or Ye Gentle Savage, which brought the house down several times. The show concluded with a thumping rendition of Bonnie Blue Flag. A month later, a group of soldiers quartered near Fredericksburg put on an all-male burlesque, in which one of the principal actors completely disrobed. Probably the most fun the soldiers had that winter were the snowball fights. Many of them had never seen snow before. Now there was lots of it, and they knew just what to do. Every time it snowed, which was frequently, there were battles, usually involving small groups of soldiers. But on at least one occasion they mounted a fight on a massive scale. Two armies were formed, of 2,500 men each, complete with authentic generals, colors, signal corps, fifers and drummers beating the long roll, couriers and cavalry. They conducted head-on assaults and flank attacks. There were formal demands under flags of truce and fortifications everywhere. "It was probably the greatest snowball battle ever fought," wrote one participant, "and showed that men are but children of larger growth. If all battles would terminate that way, it would be a great improvement on the old slaughtering plan." Robert E. Lee, who came out to observe the battle, was struck by several snowballs. The Richmond newspapers each devoted several columns to accounts of the fight. The sweetest and saddest moment of this dreamy season came one evening when several Union bands appeared on the northern bank of the Rappahannock to play some favorites. Songs, such as "When This Cruel War Is Over," by far the most popular, "Tenting Tonight on the Old Campground," "John Brown's Body," and "The Battle Cry of Freedom." Thousands of soldiers in groups on the hillside sang along while the rebels listened. Finally, the Confederates called out across the river, "Now play one of ours." Without missing a beat, the Yankee bands pitched into "Dixie," "The Bonnie Blue Flag," and "Maryland, My Maryland." They ended the concert by playing "Home Sweet Home," with 150,000 men on both sides choking up as they sang it. Before the war, Jackson had said on several occasions how much he admired the ministry as a profession and how deeply he was drawn to it. He understood at the same time that he was unsuited for it. He was a poor public speaker. He was shy. Thus, what almost certainly would have been his principal calling in life became his avocation, from his work as a deacon at the Presbyterian Church in Lexington and his management of the Sunday School, to his behind-the-scenes efforts to promote religion in the ranks. But at no time in his life was he more actively involved in these Christian pursuits than during the winter at Moss Neck, and at no time did he have so large an effect on the religious life of the Confederate Army. Perhaps his most ardent desire after peace itself was to lead what he often called a converted army. His efforts were rooted in his own reluctance to make his feelings and beliefs public, though he felt considerable pressure to do so. You suggest that I give my views and wishes in such form and extent as I am willing should be made public, he wrote Reverend White in Lexington. This I shrink from doing, because it looks like presumption in me. To come before the public and even intimate what course I think should be pursued by the people of God. He preferred to push privately, and push he did, hard, starting with what he saw as the main problem, the lack of chaplains in the army. He had discovered that more than half of the regiments in his Second Corps had no chaplains at all. He aimed to fix that. His first move was to bring his friend B. Tucker Lacey into camp. Lacey was 6 years older than Jackson, and for the years immediately before the war, had been pastor of a Presbyterian church in Frankfort, Kentucky. He was a strong and inspirational speaker, with a gift for organization. Though he had arrived at Moss Neck in the expectation of being a regimental chaplain, Jackson, who contributed $700 of his own money to Lacey's support, soon made him, in effect, the religious overseer of his entire corps. Jackson housed him in his personal residence and gave him one of his horses to use. The Lacey-Jackson plan to help promote religious awakening in the Army had two parts. First, chaplains had to be recruited, and money had to be found to pay them, which included lobbying Richmond. The effort was entirely non-denominational. Jackson insisted that no sectarian distinctions be drawn. As a general rule, he wrote Reverend White, I do not think that a chaplain who would preach denominational sermons should be in the army. Jackson had already done some of this work, but the effort was now much more ambitious and more systematic. He spent considerable time writing recruitment letters. At one point he found two soldiers who had gone into the army just before they had finished their theological courses at seminary. Jackson offered them leave to get their licenses, and then found places for them as regimental pastors. He also allowed his name to be used by his friends, quietly, in their own efforts to lobby the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church, which soon began dispatching ministers to the camps. Second, the chaplains were formed into a tightly organized association, run by Lacey, which held weekly meetings, the main point of which was to extend religious services to as many parts of the Corps as possible. Though Jackson, in his own words, did not wish to provoke any criticism by being personally prominent, he kept a tight rein on Lacey and the committee's activities. "Now come and report," he would tell Lacey after each meeting. Jackson himself contributed $300 to pay for Bibles and other religious reading, and was instrumental in recruiting prominent ministers as guest preachers. Jackson's work paid off quickly. Services grew in number and size, and soon were being conducted all over his corps. On March 27, designated by Jefferson Davis as a national day of prayer, more than 50 sermons were preached in the Corps. The Stonewall Brigade built its own chapel out of logs. Other regiments and brigades followed. In late spring, a large open-air chapel, capable of holding 2,000 or more soldiers, was built near Hamilton's Crossing. Jackson, whose headquarters was nearby, was a constant presence at the services there, as were other generals, including Robert E. Lee. Wrote Robert Louis Dabney, "The example of so famous a warrior, the curiosity to see him and the galaxy of celebrities who came to worship with him, soon drew a vast congregation to this spot." That winter, Jackson also held informal prayer meetings with his staff during their mess. Still, Jackson worried about the godliness of his country and his army. He wanted more than just a great awakening in his camps. In a letter to his old friend and business partner, and Maggie's husband, J.T.L. Preston, he wanted the Southern nation itself to officially embrace God, saying that he thought the United States had taken unnecessarily extreme means to separate church and state. He wrote, "Let our government acknowledge the God of the Bible as its God, and we may expect soon to be a happy and independent people." Though there was no fighting that winter, Jackson was caught up, like everyone else, in the great political and administrative swirl that was the Army of Northern Virginia. There was the huge backlog in the courts-martial to attend to, including death sentences that Jackson, as usual, upheld, though President Davis managed to commute some of them. There were battle reports to file, stretching back a year, the writing of which Jackson delegated to his new chief of staff, former congressman and minister to France, Charles Faulkner. The severe Roman simplicity that Jackson insisted on, plus Faulkner's inexperience, made the reports often maddeningly incomplete. Jackson also had to navigate the usual political intrigues that surrounded staff promotions and transfers, which included the departure of his brother-in-law D.H. Hill for the Western Theater. The prickly Hill had clashed with his superiors, including Lee, and though Jackson tried, he'd been unable to patch it up. As usual, Jackson was forced to grapple with the other Hill, the brilliant, stubborn, and recalcitrant A.P., who continued to insist, over Lee's objections, on the resolution of the charges pending against him. While the controversy smoldered and accusations and counter-accusations flew, a more serious confrontation occurred. On March 8, Hill filed his report on the Battle of Cedar Mountain, offering explanations for his slow marches that were the cause of his arrest in the first place. Hill not only denied any delinquency, but also accused Jackson of giving conflicting orders. Jackson was furious. Instructing his staff to collect every possible piece of evidence, he wrote an unusually long comment on Hill's report that rebutted point by point everything Hill had said. Now it was A.P. Hill's turn to explode in anger. The feud simmered on into April with a dispute over an order from Hill to a staff member that countermanded one of Jackson's orders. That was the end of Jackson's patience. He immediately forwarded charges and specifications against Hill for the Cedar Mountain incidents, all of which seemed petty enough today, failed to move as directed from Orange Courthouse towards Culpeper Courthouse on August 8, but on April 24 submitted a new and startling request of Lee. "When an officer orders in his command such disregard for the orders of his superiors, I am of the opinion that he should be relieved from duty with his command, and I respectfully request that General Hill be relieved from duty in my corps." Jackson was asking Lee to dismiss the commander of the finest division in his army. Lee, exasperated that he could not contain this feud between his talented generals, took no immediate action. A postscript to the affair was written later by Jed Hotchkiss, whose accounts of the war were generally accurate, fair, and reasonable. A.P. Hill, he wrote, found in every order that was issued to him something to complain of. Only a surly obedience was rendered by Hill and his subordinates to orders from Corps headquarters. All of this was more or less business as usual in Jackson's army. What was not at all usual was the visit on April 20 of Anna Jackson and her 5-month-old daughter Julia. Jackson had always wanted them to come, but the baby was still very young and had been sick several times, once with a severe case of chickenpox. And the trip from North Carolina would be long and hard. Jackson missed them terribly and wrote a series of long, affectionate letters to Anna to that effect over the winter. "How much I do want to see you and our darling baby," he wrote on January 5. "But I don't know when I shall have this happiness, as I am afraid, since hearing so much about the little one's health, that it would be imprudent to bring it upon a journey, so I must just content myself. Mrs. General Longstreet, Mrs. General A.P. Hill, and Mrs. General Rhodes have all been to see their husbands. Yesterday I saw Mrs. Rhodes at church, and she looked so happy that it made me wish I had Mrs. Jackson here, too. But whilst I cannot see my wife and baby, it is a great comfort to know that you have a darling little pet to keep you company in my absence." In other letters, he told her that he missed their home, missed gardening and preparing his hotbeds, and described some of the gifts he received from as far away as London. In February, he wrote, "If you could hear me talking to my esposa in the mornings and evenings, it would make you laugh, I'm sure. It is the funny way I talk to her when she's hundreds of miles away." Though we do not have Anna's own letters, by her own account they were full of love, hope, and a deep desire to see her family reunited. Mother and baby arrived by train at midday at Guiney's Station, south of Jackson's camp. It was raining. Jackson leaped aboard the train in his dripping raincoat, pushed his way through the crowd, and finally found them. "His face was all sunshine and gladness," wrote Anna. "And after greeting his wife, it was a picture indeed to see his look of perfect delight and admiration as his eyes fell upon that baby." Cheers erupted from the soldiers on the railroad platform, while Jackson and his family boarded their carriage and rode away to their lodgings at a brick estate known as Belvoir. Once inside, Jackson took off his wet coat and held his daughter in his arms. During the visit, he would hold her as often as he could, walking to and fro with her, holding her up to the mirror. "Now, Miss Jackson, look at yourself," and kneeling over her cradle when she slept. 3 days later, on her 5-month birthday, Julia Laura Jackson was baptized by the Reverend Tucker Lacey, with a small crowd of raptly attentive officers in attendance. Anna and the baby were wildly popular among the soldiers, who ventured great distances just to get a look at them. It did not hurt that the 31-year-old Anna was slim, good-looking, and unlike her reserved husband, extremely outgoing. She and Little Miss Stonewall, as one officer called the baby, received many social calls from officers, including one from General Lee, who stopped by with several members of his staff to pay their respects. Troops would be brought near the house for parade and review, and the baby would be taken out so that everybody could get a look. Mainly the men were just curious to see the stern, unemotive taskmaster in his nearly unimaginable role as doting father and husband. Douglas thought him the model of a quiet, well-behaved first father. On a pleasant and breezy April 26, Jackson and Anna attended religious services at the open-air chapel near Jackson's headquarters, where 2,000 men heard Tucker Lacey preach a sermon on the parable of Lazarus and the dead man, which Anna found earnest and edifying. The two spent that afternoon together talking. "His conversation was more spiritual than I had ever observed before," Anna wrote later. The Jacksons were thrilled to be together again. Anna had never seen him healthier or as handsome. Though he worked most of the day at his headquarters, he would come home in the afternoon and devote the rest of his time to his wife and baby. He even showed off for them. He arrived one morning mounted on a splendid bay horse he had received as a gift. He let everyone look at the horse, then remounted, spun around, and galloped away at such a speed that his hat fell off. He did not stop to pick it up. Anna was duly impressed with her war hero husband. "As far as he could be seen," she wrote, "he was flying like the wind, the impersonation of fearlessness and manly vigor." Then, quite abruptly, their domestic happiness ended. Sometime before dawn, Jubal Early's adjutant galloped into the yard at Belvoir and knocked loudly on the door. Early's division held Jackson's left flank. The news the adjutant carried was that Joseph Hooker, now in command of the Union Army, was on the move. His troops had been spotted fording the river in heavy fog 2 miles below the town. The war was on again. Anna and the baby must hurry to Richmond. Jackson kissed them goodbye, mounted Little Sorrel, and rode away. Anna packed quickly, and soon Reverend Lacey arrived with an ambulance wagon, saying that General Jackson had sent him to take them to the train station. He carried a note from Jackson invoking God's blessing and telling Anna and Julia that he loved them. The visit had lasted exactly 9 days. As they left, Hooker's big guns were already thundering from the riverbank, rattling the windows of the house. The spring campaign had begun. Chapter 44. Cometh the hour, cometh the man. Sometime deep in the afternoon of April 30, 1863, Robert E. Lee and his staff rode to the top of a high promontory near Fredericksburg, known as Telegraph Hill. From its ramparts, cleared of trees by his orders, Lee had directed the Battle of Fredericksburg 4.5 months earlier. From here he had watched the seemingly endless waves of blue-uniformed men crash on the killing grounds below the sunken road. He had watched Jackson's bloody rout of Meade and Gibbon, which had prompted him to comment, "It is well that war is so terrible, or we would grow too fond of it." Today he had come not to see men fight, but to try to understand his enemy's mind. Though he had grown accustomed to thwarting the well-laid plans of his Union counterparts, he had been caught off guard by large federal troop movements in the preceding 2 days. Now it was his turn to be puzzled. From the hilltop he watched the Federals intently for some time. Then he closed his glass, turned to a staff officer, and said, "The main attack will come from above." By above he meant to the west, upstream on the Rappahannock, where a large chunk of the Union Army had suddenly materialized 12 miles due west of his main force in Fredericksburg, behind him. Lee was right, and he knew it, even though most of his officers did not agree with him. But this was not exactly good news. It meant that his adversary, Major General Joseph Hooker, known fondly to his men as Fighting Joe, and referred to contemptuously by Lee as Mr. F.J. Hooker, had stolen a march on him. It was that very contempt that had gotten Lee into this trouble. Hooker, as it turned out, was not at all like the man he replaced. Though the 48-year-old general was seen in the army as a pushy, self-promoting opportunist who happily disparaged others to advance himself and was fonder of strong drink than he ought to be, he was also an aggressive fighter and, to everyone's surprise, a talented administrator. He had inherited a demoralized army from Ambrose Burnside and in 3.5 months given it back its snap. He replaced incompetent officers and reduced absenteeism. He streamlined operations and improved food, sanitation, campsites, and even clothing. Hospitals were cleaned up. Pay arrived on time. There was order and clarity and purpose in the camps. And the men could feel it. There was a sense, too, reminiscent of the old McClellan days, that the high command cared once again about the fate of the ordinary soldier. One of Hooker's most important moves was to revamp his intelligence service, now known as the Bureau of Military Information. Unlike the bizarrely incompetent Alan Pinkerton, the BMI delivered consistently accurate estimates of rebel troop strength. Hooker, who had 159,329 men in his army, of whom roughly 135,000 were infantry, cavalry, and artillery, knew for a fact that Robert E. Lee had roughly 55,000 infantry available to fight. For the first time in the war, a Union commander had a clear picture, literally brigade by brigade and general by general, of his enemy's strength. Hooker, moreover, had a plan, and it was a good one, and it did not depend on reckless and sacrificial assaults on entrenched Confederate positions. He had put it in motion on Sunday, April 27, with elaborate secrecy, while Anna and Thomas Jackson were listening to Reverend Lacey preach at the open-air church at Hamilton's Crossing. That day, Hooker launched his flying column. 3 full army corps, stripped to the bare essentials of fighting, carrying 8 days' rations, on a march that covered more than 30 miles for some units, around the rebel army's extended left flank. Brilliantly executed and completely unknown to Lee, who had been fooled by a simple ruse of the Union Signal Corps into deploying his intelligence-gathering cavalry too far upstream, 40,000 men, 9 batteries and their assorted trains, had tramped off to the west and south, crossed both the Rappahannock and the Rapidan, then swung east toward Lee's flank and rear. By April 30, the Union flanking column, the 5th Corps under George G. Meade, the 12th Corps under Henry W. Slocum, and the 11th under Oliver O. Howard, were all camped in the vicinity of a little crossroads called Chancellorsville. They were soon joined by Darius Couch's 2nd Corps. What Lee had finally understood, squinting through his telescope that afternoon, was that the threat to his army's existence came not from the 1st and 6th Corps sitting in front of Jackson, though they were 40,000 strong, but from this massive turning movement to his west. The 1st and the 6th, were merely there to hold the Confederate army in place, while Hooker's main column rolled up its flank. Lee was still unaware of the third and equally menacing component of Hooker's plan, a cavalry strike at his supply line between Richmond and Fredericksburg. The previous day, Jackson's quiet West Point roommate, George Stoneman, and 10,000 Union horsemen had taken off on a long looping ride far above the Confederate left. Their mission was to destroy Lee's railroad link to Richmond, and thus the line by which all of his supplies moved. By these movements, Hooker planned to force Lee out of his entrenchments and into the open, where he would either have to fight or retreat on Richmond. By April 30, everything was going exactly as planned. Robert E. Lee, meanwhile, the great strategic and tactical genius, had failed to anticipate any of this. The best evidence of this failure was that as Hooker's men were marching, fully a quarter of Lee's army was running an errand some 80 miles away in southeastern Virginia. Two crack divisions under James Longstreet, John Bell Hood's and George Pickett's, had been dispatched in February to blunt a suspected movement toward Richmond by the Union Ninth Corps. When that threat failed to materialize, the Confederate force stayed to gather much-needed food and forage for the army, shipping it up on rail lines through Richmond, and to try to capture the Union garrison at Suffolk. Longstreet was busy laying siege to that town when he received Lee's call for help, sent on April 29 and received on April 30. But Lee had already waited too long. Longstreet would not be able to even start north until May 3. Lee would have to fight Hooker's army with what he had. But before he did anything else, Lee had to throw something in the way of Hooker's oncoming legions. He had already ordered Major General Richard H. Anderson to fall back from the river with his 9,000 men and establish a defensive line east of Chancellorsville. Now he summoned Jackson. Jackson, predictably, had wanted to attack the Federal troops who had crossed the Rappahannock on the foggy morning of April 29 and were now in his front. It was the sound of the guns covering their crossing that had awakened him and led to Anna's hasty departure. Lee, who did not agree with Jackson, had nevertheless indulged this idea. But having studied the enemy's dispositions, Jackson now told Lee he concurred that it would be inexpedient to attack there. By that he meant that massed Federal artillery on Stafford Heights would blast him out of existence if he tried. Instead, Lee now ordered a massive shift to his left, sending most of Lafayette McLaws's division, plus three of Jackson's divisions, under Robert Rhodes, Raleigh Colston, and A.P. Hill, to join Anderson east of Chancellorsville. He left only a single division, plus one attached brigade, of 12,000 men under Jubal Early, to defend the heights west and south of Fredericksburg. Lee thus committed four-fifths of his available army under Jackson's command to stopping Hooker's flanking column. Jackson was thrilled with the prospect. He was always in high mood before battle, but today, whether it was due to Anna's visit or the long lapse in fighting, he was as animated as his staff had ever seen him. "I well remember the elation of Jackson," wrote his ordnance officer William Allen. "He seemed full of life and joy. His whole demeanor was cheerful and lively compared with his usual quiet manner." Back in Chancellorsville, the Union command was indulging in a small orgy of self-congratulation. They had been outmaneuvered, outflanked, outmarched, and outgamed so many times by Lee and Jackson that they could scarcely believe this new scheme was working so well. Hooker had earlier boasted to a group of officers, "My plans are perfect, and when I start to carry them out, may God have mercy on General Lee, for I will have none." Which might have seemed more of that standard-issue, high-command Union bloviation, familiar from the days of Pope and McClellan, except that the plan had worked perfectly so far. They had outfoxed the master. Three Army Corps had executed a difficult and nearly flawless sequence of maneuvers that had surprised Lee and placed them squarely on his flank. Now they were being reinforced. Full of confidence and pride, Hooker issued a general order to his army that read, "It is with heartfelt satisfaction that the commanding general announces to the army that the operations of the last 3 days have determined that our enemy must either ingloriously fly or come out from behind his defenses and give us battle on our own ground, where certain destruction awaits him." The order was greeted with cheers. Except for the bit about certain destruction, everything Hooker said was accurate. Chancellorsville was not really a town at all. It was not even a hamlet. It was barely a crossroads. The place consisted of a single, large, 2.5-story brick house, with a columned porch and a couple of outbuildings. The house was the residence of the widow Fanny Chancellor, her young son, and 7 good-looking daughters, plus a handful of local refugees. Partly on the strength of the comely daughters, it had become a sort of social center during that extended, languorous Confederate winter. Dinner guests included Generals Dick Anderson and Jeb Stuart, and the dashing Mississippi Brigadier Carnet Posey. The girls loved Stuart above all, with his perfect manners, his plumed hat, and his perpetual good humor. The fun and ringing laughter had ended with the arrival of the Yankees, who took over the house for use as Hooker's headquarters, including all of its most comfortable rooms, consigning the unhappy residents to one crowded wing. More important for the 200,000 men who were about to fight here was the peculiar terrain surrounding the Chancellor House. People called it the Wilderness of Spotsylvania, or just the Wilderness. The name was well chosen. It was a dense tangle of forest that spread 12 miles long and 6 miles deep on the flanks of the Rappahannock. There had been an iron industry here since colonial times, and the trees had all been cut down to make charcoal for furnaces and foundries. The vegetation that had grown back was a stunted, thorny snarl of dwarf pine, cedar, hickory, scrub oak, and assorted brambles. Though the woodland was pierced here and there by a few roads, much of it was indeed dark, impenetrable, trackless, labyrinthine, and often swampy wilderness. In all of its more than 70 square miles, there were only a few cleared areas, most of which lay athwart the 2 main east-to-west roads that ran through it, the Orange Turnpike and the looping and intermittent Orange Plank Road. The largest of these was a 70-acre open area around the Chancellor House. There was nothing pretty or pleasant about the wilderness. It would soon become apparent to many soldiers that as a place to fight a battle, these dark woods were something out of a nightmare. Jackson's men marched from their camps below Fredericksburg in the light of a brilliant moon that yielded in the early dawn to a thick, watery mist. They left quietly, all 24,000 of them, and headed west. By 11 a.m. on May 1, most of them had reached General Anderson's division, which was busily digging in along a ridge about 3.5 miles east of Chancellorsville that crossed both the Orange Turnpike and the Orange Plank Road. There they confronted Hooker's army and braced themselves for the inevitable attack. Lee's trust in Jackson was such, by this point in the war, that he'd given him only the broadest guidelines for action. "Make arrangements to repulse the enemy," he had said, which allowed Jackson to handle the problem as he saw fit. Jackson knew at the same time that it was Lee's ultimate desire to drive Hooker back across the Rapidan. That suited him just fine. And so, upon assuming command near the Zoan Church, he told the troops under Anderson and McLaws to put down their picks and spades, climb out of their trenches, and prepare to attack. There's no way to know Jackson's thought process as he prepared to engage the Union Army in front of him. He knew very little about it, and certainly he had no idea that at the moment he ordered his men to advance, he was actually outnumbered 5-1. But it was characteristic of the man that his means of determining the enemy's strength was to hit the enemy in the face and then see what happened. Typical, too, was his impatience to fight. As at Port Republic, he chose to attack before his full force had arrived. Hooker, meanwhile, a few miles to the west, was unaware that Jackson himself had taken the field against him. Jackson's movements under cover of night and fog had gone completely undetected, and Hooker's latest intelligence still placed the entire Second Corps on the heights below Fredericksburg. The Union commander thus believed he was facing only the divisions of Lafayette McLaws and Richard Anderson. They would be dug in, he believed, and he expected them to fight a defensive battle. With his superior numbers, he would spread their flanks and make short work of them. At roughly 10:30 a.m., Hooker signaled the start of a three-pronged advance, stacked north to south. George Meade with two divisions on the River Road, George Sykes with one division on the Orange Turnpike, and Henry Slocum on the Plank Road with another two divisions. They would move forward, link up, and, if all went well, carry the heights of Fredericksburg by 2 p.m. At almost exactly the same moment, Jackson signaled his own advance. To the amazement of the Union command, which had not expected to be attacked, his rapidly advancing columns slammed into the two lower prongs of Hooker's attacking force. Jackson not only had the element of pure surprise, but also by hitting the Federal columns head-on and hitting them early, he deprived them of their ability to communicate with one another and, as they had planned, to join forces. Meade's two 5th Corps divisions in the north were isolated from their comrades and out of the fight, while McLaws hit Sykes in the center with superior numbers, and Jackson stopped Slocum cold almost before he got started. By 1 p.m., Hooker knew that his plan had gone badly awry. So had his strategy at Fredericksburg. He had ordered John Sedgwick to threaten an attack in full force below the town, but Sedgwick had done nothing at all. That was because, due to faulty telegraphs, Sedgwick would not even receive those orders until almost 5 p.m. By now, Hooker was beginning to understand what was happening to him. He received more bad news. A large Confederate force had detached from Fredericksburg and marched west. Thus, his opponent on the field was almost certainly not Richard Anderson, but Stonewall Jackson himself. And so when Union General George Sykes, fighting astride the Orange Turnpike, reported that he was heavily outnumbered and that his flanks were being turned, this information took on new meaning. Sykes not only could not be rescued easily, but also with Jackson on the field, the divisions under Meade and Slocum might be threatened too. At about 2 p.m., Hooker issued orders to all three columns to withdraw. Jackson, as always, pursued. But the Federals managed disciplined countermarches under fire, and Jackson's last-ditch attempt at a flank attack was repulsed by Hooker's heavy artillery. In spite of his natural predatory instincts, Jackson knew that a frontal assault on Hooker's entrenched, U-shaped defensive position at Chancellorsville would have been suicidal. The day ended with Hooker's troops in exactly the same position they had been in at dawn. Jackson's men were 2 miles in advance of Anderson's entrenchments. Jackson had won the day. Hooker's huge army was suddenly penned up in dense thickets, where its numbers meant far less than they would have on open ground. In spite of his repulse and his failure to take the high ground at Zoan Church, which should have been readily his, Hooker was undaunted. He believed he had accomplished his main purpose, flushing Lee from his defensive position and out into the open, and that he was now in a position to fight a defensive battle on my own ground. That was how he saw it, anyway. He was, moreover, expecting word from George Stoneman any minute that the rebels' railroad supply line had been cut. What he did not comprehend was that while his individual decisions may have been perfectly rational, and while he held, technically speaking, one of the stoutest defensive positions of the war, he had also surrendered the initiative to Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. And that was a very dangerous thing to do. Just how important Jackson's presence was in Hooker's decision to withdraw is impossible to know, but it likely loomed large. Hooker later explained his retreat by saying that he believed he was hazarding too much to continue the movement, and that because of the difficulty of deploying his troops in the wooded terrain, he was apprehensive about being whipped in detail. Both statements might have referred to Jackson. Jackson's name alone may not have been worth 2 divisions, as an observer once suggested, but it was still enough to inspire prudence and caution in even a hard-fighting man like Joe Hooker, whom Jackson had fought to a bloody standstill in the cornfield at Antietam, and who had been fully present for Jackson's tactical masterstroke at 2nd Manassas. Whatever Hooker's thoughts, Jackson by this point in his meteoric and still ascendant career cast a large shadow, far larger than the sum of his flesh-and-blood parts. There was something fateful about him, something foreordained, as though he had been born to occupy precisely this moment in time and space, as though his strange and mystical communion with God had granted him special power over both his own men and his enemies. His personal oddities now fueled the legend. Though James Longstreet was a good general and a resolute fighter, he was a prosaic and somewhat colorless human being. Jackson, by contrast, remote, silent, eccentric, and reserved, his hand raised in prayer in the heat of battle, suggested darkness and mystery and magic. Longstreet inspired respect, Jackson, fear and awe. There are several remarkable accounts of him by his own men as he rode to battle on that day. Men trying to put into words what it was like to see the living myth as he passed by. North Carolina Colonel R.T. Bennett described seeing Jackson on his way to Tabernacle Church that morning, surrounded by the booming cheers of the men. Suddenly the sound of a great multitude who had raised their voices in accord came over the tips of the bayonets, he wrote. The very air of heaven seemed agitated. The horse and his rider cross our vision. The simple Presbyterian elder, anointed of God, with clenched teeth, a very statue, passes to his transfiguration. Other descriptions of him have this same oddly mystical cast. The people of the Confederate States had begun to regard this immortal leader as above the reach of fate, wrote John Esten Cooke in his 1863 biography. Later that day, Edward Porter Alexander watched Jackson and Lee ride by together at the head of a column of men to more wild cheering. His brief description of Jackson in that moment was one of the most memorable of the war. As a fighter and a leader, Alexander wrote of the once scorned college professor, he was all that can ever be given to a man to be. While Joe Hooker attended to his troop dispositions in the comfort of the Chancellor House that evening and put the final touches on his prodigious defensive lines, Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson were sitting on a log near the intersection of the Orange Plank and Catherine Furnace Roads, talking. They had met at about 7 p.m. after Jackson had called off his attack and had made their way to a sheltered clearing on the northwest quadrant of the intersection to avoid federal sharpshooters. Their conference lasted several hours. Staff officers and various generals came and went. Gunshots from the front line sputtered and finally died out. Darkness fell. Later on, when those observers understood the full historic significance of this conversation, they would strain to remember something, anything, about what they had seen or heard. The meeting began with a discussion of the day's battle. Jackson told Lee in detail what he had seen, and expressed his surprise at the ease with which the enemy had been driven back to Chancellorsville, as Fitzhugh Lee remembered the conversation. Jackson believed that Hooker would withdraw by morning. Lee had a different idea. As he saw it, Hooker's quick retreat simply meant that he wanted to fight a defensive battle. Instead of withdrawing, he was digging in, and daring Lee to attack. Lee was right, as it turned out, and he fully intended to oblige his adversary. The question was how. As the two generals conversed, Confederate reconnaissance parties were scouting the margins of the Union position, probing for weakness. Hooker's center was almost absurdly strong, unassailable. There were five Army Corps on the Chancellorsville front, arrayed in a convex, 6-mile-long line manned by nearly two-thirds of the Army of the Potomac and supported by 184 pieces of artillery. Thanks to the abundance of wood and plenty of leisure time to cut and haul it, Union lines bristled with field fortifications, abatis, and obstructions of various designs, a defender's dream. The Army's left, in the form of George Meade's tough Fifth Corps, was anchored stoutly on the Rappahannock, which meant that it could not be turned. Thus, Lee looked to the Union right, where he soon found exactly what he was looking for. Jeb Stuart's subordinate, Brigadier General Fitzhugh Lee, whose cavalry had been doing the main reconnaissance, had discovered something extraordinary out there. Rebel horsemen controlled virtually all the roads on the Confederate left, right up to the federal picket lines, and thus the eyes and ears on Hooker's right flank belonged entirely to the Confederacy. This was partly, though not entirely, because much of the Union Cavalry Corps was off with its commander, George Stoneman, trying to disrupt Confederate supply lines. Stoneman's expedition would turn out to be an epic failure and one of the worst tactical mistakes of the war. But no one knew that yet. No one in the Union High Command, in fact, had heard anything from Stoneman. Lee knew only that he was abroad with his troopers making mischief somewhere in central Virginia. But Lee now knew for certain that Hooker had left himself virtually blind in the West. Seeking advice on the terrain, Lee and Jackson summoned Reverend Tucker Lacey, whose family owned land in the area. Lacey explained that a marching column looping to the south and west could trace a long arc from Catherine Furnace that would reach the Orange Turnpike at Wilderness Tavern, about 5 miles west of Chancellorsville. This confirmed what Lee and Jackson had heard from Stuart and Fitzhugh Lee, and would put the Confederate troops well beyond Hooker's right wing. Robert E. Lee soon made his decision. He would send Jackson on a march around the Union right. Though he did not know exactly where that was, he had a clear enough idea from what Fitzhugh Lee had told him. He would leave the details of the flanking movement and subsequent attack up to Jackson. Jeb Stuart and his cavalry would screen his movements. Lee issued marching orders for the next day. Then the two generals made a simple camp in the pine woods. They spread saddle blankets on the ground, covered themselves with their overcoats, and used their saddles as pillows. Sometime after midnight, Tucker Lacey, who had camped near Jackson and Lee, awoke to find a small fire burning, and Jackson sitting alone in front of it on a Union hardtack box. "Sit down," Jackson said. "I want to talk to you." He explained that he needed more information about the roads west of Catherine Furnace. Jackson was worried that the route Lacey had suggested might bring his column too near the federal pickets. Wasn't there a way farther to the south that would make them less visible? Lacey said he did not know, but he did know someone who could plot such a route. Charles C. Welford, the proprietor of Catherine Furnace, the only operating ironworks in the area. Jackson roused his mapmaker, Hotchkiss, and dispatched him and Lacey to the Welford house, 2 miles away. There, Welford indeed suggested a better way, a road through the thickets that he had recently reopened to haul wood and iron ore, that would be invisible to just about anyone in the area. Welford volunteered his son as a guide. Hotchkiss and Lacey galloped back to camp with the news, where they found Lee and Jackson both awake and sitting on hardtack boxes by the fire. Hotchkiss pulled up a third box and spread his map out on it, showing the generals this secret passage to the enemy's rear. As Hotchkiss recalled, when he had finished his presentation, Lee turned to Jackson. "General Jackson, what do you propose to do?" Lee asked. "Go around here," Jackson replied, pointing to Welford's suggested route on the map. "What do you propose to make the movement with?" "With my whole command." "What will you leave me?" "The divisions of Anderson and McLaws." There was a pause as Lee reflected on the high-risk plan they were so calmly discussing. He had divided his army once in February, sending Longstreet south. He had divided it again the previous day, leaving Jubal Early with his single division on the heights of Fredericksburg. Now he had decided not only to divide his army a third time, but also to march the largest part of it directly across his enemy's front, roughly similar to what Edwin Sumner and John Sedgwick had done with the Union Second Corps at Antietam, where Jackson had slaughtered them like animals. Lee was betting, it was one of the most daring and perilous bets of the war, that Hooker would wait to be attacked. "Well, go ahead," Lee said. And that was all there was to it. Lee made some final notes for the orders he would have to issue. Then Jackson saluted and said, "My troops will move at once, sir." Moving at once was actually impossible, considering how much work it was going to take to get three divisions all marching and pointed in the same direction. At about 7 o'clock on the chilly morning of May 2, the lead elements of the Second Corps crossed the narrow plank road on their way to Catherine Furnace and beyond. General Lee sat on his horse by the side of the road, watching. When Jackson rode up, the two men conversed briefly. Whatever they said is lost to history. Then Jackson pointed toward the enemy's lines and rode on. With him went 29,400 men, along with 27 batteries with 108 guns. Riding on his flank were 3.5 regiments of Jeb Stuart's cavalry. In all, Jackson had 33,000 men. By agreement, he had left Lee with a meager 15,000 to face the bulk of Hooker's army. Jackson's corps was stripped down for combat. It carried only ammunition wagons and ambulances, no baggage or commissary wagons. The men marched at a rate that would cover a mile in 25 minutes, resting 10 minutes each hour. As a North Carolina private recalled, "We went swiftly forward through the wilderness, striking now and then a dim path or road. Strict silence was enforced, the men only being allowed to speak in whispers. Occasionally, a courier would spur his tired horse past us as we twisted through the brush. For hours at a time, we neither saw nor heard anything." The column wound forward along narrow paths that had been cut through the dense woods, an enormous, silent body of men making its way west. Jackson, riding at the head of the column, stopped to pick up his guide, Charles Welford. When he galloped past his men, he did so with his cap held high, while his men all raised theirs in silent tribute. It was not an easy march. Temperatures rose, and the length and narrowness of the column meant that every piece of uneven terrain and every mud hole would cause it to string out, leading to endless halting and starting, halting and starting. The last of Jackson's troops, under A.P. Hill, did not leave until 11 o'clock. Still, they pressed forward with minimal straggling. Jackson had made sure of that by placing his regimental commanders in the rear. As the hours passed, Jackson was mostly silent, but he would occasionally join the conversation of the officers who rode with him. One of them noted how many former VMI faculty and students were with the Second Corps on its march. Division commanders Robert Rhodes and Raleigh Colston had both been professors there. Rhodes, a VMI graduate, had left his teaching job there when the full professorship he wanted was given to newcomer Thomas J. Jackson in 1851. Colston had accompanied Jackson and his cadets when they traveled to Richmond in April 1861. Artillery Chief Stapleton Crutchfield had been a student of Jackson's. Cavalry Colonel Tom Munford had been the ranking cadet at VMI when Jackson had first arrived, had treated the odd new professor kindly, and the two had become friends. Brigadier General James H. Lane had been a student of Jackson's and later taught mathematics at VMI. There were, in fact, 20 brigadiers and colonels of line and staff that day who were VMI graduates. Jackson, pleased with this notion, turned to Munford and said, "Colonel, the Institute will be heard from today." At about 2:30 p.m., the head of Jackson's column came to a halt at the Orange Plank Road, 3 miles west of Chancellorsville. May 2 was an odd day for Joseph Hooker, as much for what did not happen as for what did. He remained supremely confident in his position, had passed this confidence on to his general officers, and they all agreed that their success was virtually guaranteed. For once, they had reliable estimates of rebel troop strength and knew they held better than a 2-to-1 advantage over Lee. They knew that Longstreet was too far away to make any difference. They held immensely strong defensive positions that extended all the way to the Rappahannock and shielded their own supply lines. Hooker's main concern was Stoneman, riding with 10,000 men somewhere in the rebel rear, but unheard from for 4 days. Hooker expected he would hear very soon that his cavalry commander had succeeded and that the rebel communications had been cut, which meant that Fighting Joe once again held both the initiative and the upper hand. For the moment, he could only do his best to shore up his position. That meant strengthening his right, which consisted of O.O. Otis Howard's 11th Corps, a weak fighting force full of German-speaking Germans. He was known as the Christian General, a man who, like Jackson, prayed before and during battle, and spoke of war in religious terms. Unlike Jackson, he was an ineffectual commander. It was no accident that Hooker had stationed him well west of Chancellorsville in what must have seemed to him the middle of nowhere, and certainly far from whatever fighting was likely to take place. Still, he had taken pains to strengthen this wing of his army. At about 1 a.m., he had sent an order to General John Reynolds in command of the First Corps and still deployed on the Fredericksburg front. Reynolds was to move before daylight and march his entire 16,900-man force upriver, past Chancellorsville, and take a new position on the right rear of the 11th Corps. They would arrive by mid-afternoon on May 2. This meant that the questionable Howard would be well backed up. It also meant that the Union right, instead of being in the air where it now was, would be strongly anchored on the Rapidan River, 3 miles west of its confluence with the Rappahannock. This was a very good idea, especially since Hooker's troops in Fredericksburg had clearly failed to hold the Confederate forces there in place. But Hooker was once again the victim of the inept and inconsistent Union Signal Corps. Reynolds did not receive his telegraph until daylight, which meant that his men would not be in place in Chancellorsville until very late afternoon or evening. Hooker's chief of staff, Dan Butterfield, called this lapse one of the most unfortunate that has occurred. Another, even more damaging mistake would be made that morning. Starting out at about 8 a.m., Union observers sitting in tall trees began reporting an unusual and unanticipated event taking place behind rebel lines. The apparent movement south and west of a large Confederate column, complete with artillery and trains. Though most of Jackson's route of march was cloaked even from these tree-borne scouts, there was one section of road that ran along high, open ground just east of Catherine Furnace, where the column became briefly visible. The reports were passed quickly up the line. An hour and a half later, Third Corps Commander Major General Daniel Sickles personally observed the column through field glasses and secured permission from Hooker to open fire on it with his artillery. Taking no chances, Hooker sent a message to Otis Howard saying, "We have good reason to suppose that the enemy is moving to our right," and observing that the disposition you have made of your corps has been with a view to a front attack by the enemy. If he should throw himself on your flank, determine upon the position you will take in that event. He reminded Howard to keep reserves well in hand to meet this contingency. Howard read the order, discussed it briefly with one of his generals, then more or less disregarded it. He sent an officer from the Signal Corps a mile to the west, but did not reposition any of his troops. His feeling, shared by others, was that the density of the wilderness around him would be defense enough. Sickles, meanwhile, wanted to know more about this odd troop movement. At midday, he asked for and received permission from Hooker to attack the Confederate column with infantry. Actually, this was the tail of Jackson's column, which had been swinging past Catherine Furnace for more than 5 hours. Jackson had had the foresight to leave the 23rd Georgia Regiment behind to secure this vulnerable open area, and now the Georgians collided with Sickles's attacking force. There was a sharp, extended fight near the Catherine Furnace, in which 296 of the Georgians were taken prisoner. But they did the job Jackson had intended them to do, which was to keep the Union forces away from the marching column. Except for one broken-down caisson, every piece of Jackson's force passed unscathed. Even better for the success of Lee's plan was the conclusion that Sickles drew from his engagement with the 23rd Georgia. At about 1:30 p.m., he reported that what he was witnessing was actually a rebel retreat. The enemy's troops, after all, were seen moving in a southerly direction and had their trains with them. It only made sense. Sickles's message got to Hooker's headquarters at about 2 p.m., at which point the Union High Command, too, became convinced that Lee was retreating toward Gordonsville. Maybe this was because Lee's supply line had been cut, Hooker fantasized, and his enemy was marching to the Orange and Alexandria line to restore them. Further evidence to support this interpretation were reports of Jubal Early's sudden disengagement from the Fredericksburg front. They happened to be true, though the movement was entirely unintentional. As it turned out, Lee's chief of staff, Robert Chilton, had misinterpreted Lee's wishes. Lee had wanted Early to watch the Federals closely, and if they seemed to be departing for Chancellorsville, he was to leave a small holding force in place and join Lee. The orders were discretionary. But what Early got from Chilton was a peremptory directive to immediately fall back, even though the Sixth Corps was still in front of him. By 4:45 p.m., the Union command knew for certain that Early was leaving, which seemed to be final, conclusive proof of the rebel withdrawal. Orders had already gone out alerting Union commanders to replenish food and ammunition and to be ready to pursue the retreating rebel army the next morning. Now there was no doubt at all. Lee also benefited from the eventual escalation of the fight Sickles had started at Catherine Furnace. It soon drew in not only elements from Richard Anderson's Confederate divisions, but also, more important, involved some 25,000 federal troops, many of whom had been stripped down from the Union left, leaving a mile-wide gap in the line just east of Howard's 11th Corps. Though the fighting involved advances and retreats, much pounding of artillery,